Hey, welcome back to The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. Daniela here.
And Aubrey.
And Cleo here as well.
And for those of you socializing with us today, thanks for joining in.
If you at home want to join the conversation, be sure to tweet us your questions, comments, and opinions with @ISGPForum and the hashtag ISGPForum. And you'll find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
Today's podcast will discuss a debate that occurred at one of our food safety, security, and defense conferences, which was held in September 2015 in Fargo, North Dakota.
Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Food Security and Diet-Linked Public Health Challenges was the name of the conference.
And the paper in question, titled Effects of Modernization, Global Pollution, and Climate Change on Food Security Among Indigenous Peoples in the Arctic, was written by Professor Laurie Chan from the University of Ottawa.
Well, that's certainly timely, considering the fact that the Arctic seems to be on everyone's mind lately.
Is it? I mean, yeah, definitely. But remind me why?
I think Daniela is just trying to rub it in that she'll be heading up to the Norwegian Arctic on some fancy cruise soon.
Hey, no. Well, maybe just a little. But seriously, there's some big issues going on up in the Arctic. I've been doing some reading to prepare for the trip myself.
Oh yeah? Well, what'd you find?
Well, in line with Professor Chan's argument, indigenous populations residing in the Arctic regions are encountering unprecedented and rapid environmental, social, and economic changes. Traditional and country foods are critical resources that help and maintain the health and well-being of indigenous populations in the Arctic.
Sounds great. I guess I fail to see the problem.
The problem is that over the past 3 decades, there's been a major shift away from the consumption of traditional foods.
Wait, two things. First of all, what are traditional country foods? I mean, down in Florida, we would call that Cracker Barrel, but I have a feeling that's not what you're getting at.
I think what Daniela is referring to is food that is hunted and gathered as opposed to processed, packaged, and bought from suppliers. Hunted and gathered country/traditional foods include a wide variety of animal and plant species. Some prime examples include beluga whales, seal, caribou, Arctic char, and berries.
All right. Hunting and gathering. And you're saying that indigenous communities are moving away from this type of food system. Is this really a bad thing, though? Are these systems really that crucial for them?
Well, public health professionals argue that a diet rich in traditional country foods protects these communities against cardiovascular disease and diabetes because they have relatively high levels of N3 mono and polyunsaturated fatty acids and low levels of N6 fatty acids.
Not only that, but they also provide high intakes of antioxidants, vitamins, micronutrients, and phytochemicals. Phytochemicals, by the way, are basically just a range of biologically active chemicals found in plants.
And I can imagine that beyond the many nutritional benefits, the actual traditions of harvesting, processing, and consuming these foods must have great social and cultural importance for these communities, no?
Exactly. These eating patterns are deeply connected with community ethics and indigenous identities. I guess that only makes the big question of the day even more confusing. Why would indigenous populations move away from their traditional food lifestyles?
Well, a big part of the reason is modernization and environmental changes, including global pollution and climate change. These changes affect the availability of and accessibility to traditional country foods, thereby contributing to the food insecurity we're starting to see in these communities.
And this is an issue because these populations' new dietary patterns now include processed foods that are high in salt, sugar, and fat. The decreased consumption of locally harvested foods results in lower intakes of key nutrients such as protein, iron, and zinc.
And these changes in diet and lifestyle are associated with increased rates of obesity and chronic diseases, which seems to be a reoccurring topic recently amongst our world's biggest public health threats.
Whoa, should I mention that this is Daniela's favorite rant? Or could you already tell? I'm really not sure.
Hey. All right, I probably do rant about the food industry too much, but you know as well as I do how crucial these changing dietary patterns are around the world.
It's true, you're right, I'm only teasing. In any case, actually living with obesity and chronic diseases is especially difficult under conditions of increasing food insecurity. which is the situation currently experienced by Indigenous Arctic peoples.
And to be food secure, individuals and households must be able to reliably access food, and both the supply and production of nutritious food at the community level must be sufficient. That said, impediments to food security in many Arctic Indigenous households exist because of insufficient access to and availability of nutritious food.
And before we start confusing people with our lexicon, availability refers to whether or not nutritious food can physically be found in a location, whereas access is talking more about whether a person or family has the means to actually acquire the food.
Good catch, Aubrey. Thanks for that. But yeah, many studies have even shown that the food insecure rate in many Indigenous communities can reach an alarming rate of more than 50%.
But remember that food security is also related to the significant environmental changes occurring due to ecological shifts in the Arctic. These shifts can be correlated in the household with reduced confidence in food safety, since people worry about health threats from environmental contaminants.
But more recently, pressing ecological shifts have been characterized by changes in species availability and accessibility.
True, but these phenomena are intertwined. Professor Chan explains that despite residing in locations distant from industrial activity, Arctic populations are especially vulnerable to environmental contaminant exposure. Contaminants undergo long-range transport from warmer to colder regions, making the Arctic a sink for contaminant deposition.
Exactly, and because persistent organic pollutants collect in the fatty tissues of animals and accumulate at the higher ends of the food chain, when Arctic populations consume traditional fish and marine mammals, they undergo direct contaminant exposure.
Right. Exposure to global pollutants such as mercury after consuming traditional foods has been associated with subclinical biochemical effects, or a disease that has no recognizable clinical findings. Exposure has also been associated with increased systolic blood pressure in adults, as well as sensory function impairment in children in some Arctic communities.
And if our fellow ISGP staffer and medical student Sam Innes were here, she'd be happy to tell you that systolic blood pressure refers to the pressure in your arteries during heart muscle contraction.
It's represented by the top number in your blood pressure reading. You know, how there are two numbers, the top and the bottom, 120 over 80, or something like that.
Well, whether the affected blood pressure number is top or bottom, the public health end result is the same. Food consumption advisories warning the public about possible contaminant risks from marine mammal consumption are necessary.
But because of the food security challenges we outlined earlier, reductions in traditional food consumption to limit contaminant intake are likely to dramatically and negatively affect key nutrient absorption.
Okay, so let me rephrase. Food advisories should protect the population from contaminants in traditional foods in order to lower contaminant exposure while minimizing the adverse effects associated with decreased nutrient intake.
Fair point. But another important point is this. We know that humans aren't the only ones adversely affected by climate-related changes and variability in the Arctic. Animal, fish, and plant health are impacted as well, manifesting in changes to their population sizes and distribution. So why do we care? Well, these changes in environmental factors influence human travel and transportation, and notably, access to wildlife resources.
So we have to do something about this, obviously. I mean, the three of us aren't just here to lay out all the depressing climate change issues, are we?
No, Daniela, hold your horses. You know better than that. But the biggest challenge in addressing this challenge is all of the many challenges that shape this modern version of food security in the Arctic.
Did you say challenge? It's not clear to me whether this food security threat is a challenge.
Sass.
Quite challenging. A case in point is these intertwined phenomena of modernization, global pollution, and rapid and sometimes unpredictable environmental change.
Don't forget economic transitions and material poverty, changing demographics, and current logistical obstacles.
Honestly, we could go on for quite a while listing the challenges. The complexity of the interactions between these factors requires that multidisciplinary approaches be employed to understand and resolve the issue. New frameworks and paradigms that cross traditional disciplines need to be developed, and international collaborations are needed for sharing experiences and methodologies.
So if we want to find a solution, which we do, obviously, we're going to need innovative approaches in research and public health and adaptation programs.
Not to mention integrative wildlife and food system management programs.
Wait, you lost me with that one. What are those?
Oh, these are just programs that basically integrate the methods of traditional country food gathering and sustaining the wildlife population. These programs find a mutually beneficial balance between these two seemingly contradicting end goals.
Right, and the only way to implement these would be through policies at the local, national, and international levels.
And we've got to recognize the need for comprehensive risk and benefit assessment paradigms to be developed and applied.
Why risk-benefit analysis, though? Are there really any benefits associated with climate change and the impacts on dietary patterns?
Actually, she has a point. Studies have indicated that both positive and negative changes across different communities were reported in regards to climate change and variability effects on traditional food harvests.
Yep, that is true. But the impacts are not homogeneous among all hunter-gatherers and communities, and both individuals and households demonstrate differing abilities to adapt successfully.
So I'm guessing factors we mentioned earlier, such as modernization, global pollution, economic transitions, material poverty, changing demographics, and logistical obstacles probably play a role in this ability to adapt, yeah?
Yeah. But access to economic resources and equipment, experience, and the nature of the adaptive strategy used also appear to influence the success of hunter adaptations to climate conditions.
Okay, so we definitely need to keep studying the differentiating factors across individuals and households. Hey, here you go, Daniela, another idea for your dissertation.
Has she been nagging you about her dissertation proposals too?
Wow, Dee, you've been busy. You really are all over the place lately.
All right, thanks, guys. I get it. I'll agonize about my dissertation topics all by myself. Anyway, if I were to focus on this, I would have some good tools at my disposal since the relationship between A, climate projections, and B, key environmental variabilities influencing wildlife and traditional foods can be modeled. Based on the available harvest and local consumption data, it's feasible to relate wildlife harvest data to traditional country food use at both community and regional levels.
Okay, besides all the joking, maybe you should really take this research into consideration. This information is critical for our understanding of the major determinants of traditional food consumption in Arctic communities. As the pace and variability of change increases, it's important to identify key aspects of individual and collective adaptive capacity that need to be improved, if we ever want to protect traditional dietary patterns of these communities going forward.
But beyond Daniela's dissertation, there are some real-time actionable steps that can be taken to protect this lifestyle as far as legislation is concerned.
But what could be more important than my dissertation?
Seriously?
Okay, I get it. The joke's over. But seriously, what steps can be taken?
Well, for one, it is critical for researchers, health professionals, and policymakers to work together to identify the level and scope of food security.
And they must remember that individual, household, community, regional, and national contexts necessitate different types of analysis and engagement.
Right, but in these different scenarios, the key point is that community engagement is vital.
Support for autonomous community food systems, or food sovereignty, community-based research, and community-based solutions that respond to locally identified needs are all essential steps towards meeting the dual goals of achieving sustainability and local food self-sufficiency.
Wait, hold up. Food sovereignty?
Yeah, this is the principle that decisions about food systems, including markets, production modes, food cultures, and environments, be made by those who actually depend on them.
Ah, all right, gotcha. But we also need to make sure we address time frame with these clearly very pressing issues. Professor Chan argued that a continuum of programs and policies must be used to address food insecurity. These can range from short-term mitigation strategies, such as food banks and children's feeding programs, to capacity building and skills development programs like community gardens or cooperative buying clubs.
But they can also be long-term organizational changes and policy responses that focus on root causes of food insecurity.
Well, look at you two being an inseparable team. Anyway, from both of your arguments, it's clear that multi-level approaches based on intersectoral collaboration among communities, local agencies, government, and institutions are important for successful and sustainable initiatives.
And in fact, there are a number of such initiatives at grassroots levels presently. Things like community-led food assessments, community gardens.
And at provincial and territorial levels, including Manitoba's Northern Healthy Foods Initiative and the Nunavut Food Security Strategy.
All right, can you guys stop doing this tag team thing now? Anyway, initiatives can also be at the national level, as can be seen with a program in Canada called Idle No More.
Oh, you don't like the tag team thing we've got going on? Well, to build food security and food sovereignty, initiatives should aim to, hit it, Cleo,
increase the affordability and availability of healthy food, promote health and education, enhance community wellness and intergenerational knowledge sharing,
provide harvester support and sustainable wildlife management, reduce poverty and support community economic development, support innovation and infrastructure and local food production, and increase youth engagement.
I hate you both.
But you know we love you, Aubrey. That was the last one.
Promise.
All right, you two. I guess, considering your tag team approach here, you could say we do have efficient collective action on this podcast, which is also very necessary towards the sort of policy Professor Chan argues for. For global pollution and climate change, international efforts are needed to reach agreements on collective action to control the use and release of toxic chemicals and carbon dioxide.
Speaking of collective action, now it's your turn to weigh in on social media. We're looking forward to learning what you thought of today's episode.
Today, we discussed the reasons for deviation from traditional eating trends in Arctic Indigenous populations, and we also hashed out how these consumption patterns can result in poor health outcomes for Arctic peoples.
There are a myriad of challenges here to deal with, including, but not limited to, environmental degradation, biodiversity loss, local adaptation difficulties, and nutritional deficiencies. What do you think is step one in addressing this complicated network of food security impacts and implications?
Tweet us your thoughts using the hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
Don't forget to like us on Facebook as well.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today. Hope you enjoyed socializing with science, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.